And when Ron pointed out the things that were anomalous, Jim said, "Holy cow," and has now promised to spend the weekend looking, and a dialogue and a questioning process and an obvious, this does not belong, this is not geology, this is not what we were taught. But he'd been looking at these pictures since July, and himself had not come to the obvious conclusion, because the imprint of NASA can do no wrong and would not lie was overwhelmingly clouding his vision of simply looking at the pictures themselves.
I'm just grateful that, as you alluded to earlier, people in NASA are releasing pictures. There's something happening there where there's some breaking ranks.
I wanted to pick up on that. It's a very crucial point, Madeline, and it goes back to my, you know, this mantra, most of the system is honest. I was doing an interview for Atlantis Rising magazine on this, which will come out, I guess, next month, and I said something, and the reporter stopped me. He said, "Say it again. I want to write this down." I said, "They have been fooled, but they're not fools," meaning that you have three populations within NASA, which is kind of a subculture of society in general. You have a tiny, tiny handful of what I'll call the manipulators. You then have a tiny, tiny handful of those that, for want of a better name, I'll call enlighteners, meaning there are this duality, these polar opposites of a tiny group in NASA which tries to keep us from ever finding out what's really out there, and another group that surreptitiously has been trying to leak for years. And I can go through, if we have the time, all the other examples of things that we have on the public record that we wouldn't have if the suppressors, this first group, had had their way. I mean, they just would have burned the negatives. So there's got to be a counterforce group that has put this stuff there and somehow politically kept it available for those who would look. And in the middle, in this kind of Gaussian curve, are most of the people, which includes most of society, who are not fools but have been fooled. And it's that battle for the middle, for the intelligent, curious, connected middle, that this conflict is being waged. For the hearts and minds of those, where they vote, where they ask questions, where they look, where they put their discernment, will tell us if we're going to win, meaning we get at the truth, or we never find out.
What a perfect time to open the phones to our listeners. And I'd like to invite you at this time to call 818-985-5735. Direct questions or comments to Richard Hoagland. And we'll take our first call. Hi, you're on the Wee Hours.
Good evening.
Hi.
Richard.
Yes, sir.
God bless you, Richard. I was just driving home after washing my car.
Is this Randy?
Yeah.
Ah, okay. An old friend. Actually, he's kind of a young friend, but he's an old familiar friend.
But your voice wasn't very familiar. It sounded like you've been having a cold for a month and a half, Richard.
I'm down from a mile and a half. I'm at sea level again. And it's late.
And it's late.
And I've had a long day.
And you've been speaking endlessly.
And the lines are blazing, Randy, so speak.
Listen, Richard,
it.
I'm going to give you a quote here that seems to be pertinent to many things you've stated. From a book that came out in 1970, and since the theme is politics, the U.S. space program apes the old hardware economy of the pre-electric age. Electric space is not outer, but inner. NASA could have created anti-gravitational transportation long ago, except for the rear-view mirror obsession of the scientific establishment. That came out in a book in 1970. That quote was made by none other than someone who had a great insight into NASA and many other statements, namely Marshall McLuhan, of all people.
Hmm.
And since you have an insight into whether or not we have developed anti-gravitational technology, one of the other videos that I understand you're putting together is a critical analysis of the SDS-40 versus 80 footage. Maybe you could tie that into the politics of the, the different camps within NASA, because if any of those pieces of footage do show some indication that somebody has anti-gravitational technology, then the people at large should have that in their quiver of possibilities to consider whether or not, you know, we will really be in the space age, or whether, as McLuhan thinks, we're just going to plod along like actually everything's happening in the last century and not really get with it in the 21st century. And we'll see you later.
Okay, thanks, Randy. You know, that opens up, unfortunately, a tremendous can of worms, because it's not just does NASA have the scientific and technical wherewithal to do it differently from rockets and the shuttle and Newton's third law and reaction devices and stuff like that. But we know that there is a technology that was developed under black programs in the DOD, the Defense Department, photographed by people that I know, like Fred Francis took a camera crew out and parked them on a mountain overlooking a desolate region of Nevada called Area 51. And one night on the image intensifier grainy videotape that they produced, you can see these objects cavorting over the mountains, over Groom Lake. Obviously not aerodynamic, obviously not rockets, obviously not airplanes or helicopters. And Francis on the video is intoning as a voiceover, objects behaving in direct violation of the current laws of physics. And what was remarkable about the whole piece is that when he tossed it back to Tom Brokaw, who was anchoring in New York in the studio, what Brokaw asked was nothing about this dumbfounding tour de force of a violation of what we historically have thought was an immutable law of gravity and an obvious demonstration of a technology somehow under U.S. control that with abandon can violate those conventions. Brokaw asked Francis, well, is it under budget? I mean, the myopia of a monetary question against the universe beckoning and the farthest star accessible to human exploration, it was the quintessential example of why the major media are no more the early warning system of the human species than my cat. Because they're looking at the wrong end of the telescope. They're looking at the wrong planet. They're looking at the wrong reality. Yes, Randy, we know how to control gravity. There is overwhelming evidence documented in military studies, in conferences, in intimations of hardware that's been photographed by official NASA shuttle video and downlinked live, which we have, pieces of, that someone under our own political aegis, meaning the U.S. or some power on this planet, knows how to control gravity and build vehicles that can manipulate gravity and can go anywhere in hours where normally it takes literally years or decades to get there with rockets. Now, where the rubber meets the road is that in a few days, a few hours if we want to be metaphorical, there will be leaving for Saturn from Cape Canaveral a very controversial NASA mission called Cassini. And on board Cassini are 72 pounds of plutonium, required, we are told, to provide electricity for the mission. They have told us there is a Hobson's choice, that it's either solar power, which means you could never lift the solar panels to provide enough electricity at the distance of Saturn, or you send plutonium and you make electricity that way, and thereby you have a mission. Well, the most remarkable polarization of polemic and politics have occurred around this apparent awful choice. Do we have knowledge of Saturn, or do we sit at home because we can't lift the solar panels? That kind of thing. Knowing of these studies in anti-gravity, knowing of the existence of the video and having it of shuttle missions where something behaving under anti-gravitational control in Earth orbit was in fact photographed, among other places, over 19.5, over the Amazon jungles last December. Knowing that if you have control of anti-gravity, you have control of unlimited pollutionless power, energy. You don't need nukes, you don't need solar, you don't need anything. You've got the universe by the string. So the Hobson's choice, the awful agonizing choice between knowledge or nothing, is a false dichotomy put in place by those who would control not just our knowledge base and what is out there, but the very reality of a physics that could liberate every single human being, all 6 billion on this planet tonight, most of whom lead terrible, desperate lives of material lack and starvation because of lack of abundant, clean, cheap, non-polluting, ecologically friendly energy, which this technology under NASA's control could give us. That's the perniciousness of Cassini. Not the choice, but the hiding of the secret agenda, that the choice is a false choice. There's a third choice that is not even in the running.
Let's take another call. Hi, you're on the wee hours.
Yes. Let me get sort of this. It appears to me that the discovery of the pyramids on Mars have strong racial implications, specifically pointing towards Egypt, which is in Africa, and black people specifically. I'm wondering if KPFK, the station KPFK, and the host of the show will give Mr. Hoagland full latitude and freedom to speak to that issue. He said earlier that he attended a lecture earlier this evening that consisted primarily of people of color. And if he can specify who the host of that show was and what the relationship to this is. And I'm just wondering, is there a deliberate avoidance of speaking about the racial implications? And can you address any of that?
Well, I understand the spirit of the question, and I have, in the last 15 years of doing this, I've never avoided a question. I've never avoided, you know, even a sensitive discussion. But I am going to avoid it tonight, and I'll tell you why. Because we're not ready. What I want to do, and what I will do in due course, which may be a few months or a few more months from now, there are certain pieces of data that are coming in, and we have research people as part of Enterprise digging very assiduously through certain archives and literally going to sources that are not normally open and available to most researchers. I want to be very careful what I put on the record because it is a politically sensitive topic. It, to me, is an entrancing topic. It's extraordinarily pregnant with all kinds of wondrous possibilities. And what I went to Compton tonight to listen to was an academic, a PhD, a recognized scholar who for the last 20-some years has almost single-handedly, not quite, but almost single-handedly held the position that the Americas were peopled and populated by highly intelligent, highly skilled, highly efficient, and well-developed forerunners of civilization from Africa who left imprints in all kinds of elegant ways here in the Americas that the traditional European-oriented scholarship has simply not taken note of. And what I went to Compton tonight to do was to basically meet with this individual to set up a context for further quiet discussions, which will take place, that was affirmed tonight, to meet with LeGrand Clegg, who was the kind of master of ceremonies and the chairman who put this presentation on at Compton College tonight, who is the city attorney of the city of Compton, who we will meet with in the next few days. And he is a member of Enterprise. You know, LeGrand and I have known each other for several years. We had only met briefly one time before. We've both been looking, it turns out, at separate parts of an extraordinarily interesting and much larger and more complex and more meaningful puzzle. And what I don't want to do is to speak out of turn about the parts of the puzzle until we're ready. And then I will have no compunctions of laying it on the table and letting everybody have at it.
Would you divulge the person that was speaking, or is that something you're not comfortable
Suzanne?
Doing?
Oh, no. You know something? I can't remember his name.
Van Sertima.
What is
Dr.
it?
Ivan Van Sertima.
Van Sertima. Okay.
Van Sertima, yeah. He's the African studies professor from Rutgers. But what I wanted to say was that LeGrand Clegg has a wonderful a website up.
Yes.
And I don't know the URL for it, but it he has a video series that he produced called When Black Men Ruled the World, and he's really, you know, one of the great spokespeople for this whole perspective, and that website is beautiful, and if you get on it, you will see, you know, if you're looking for this kind of information,
okay,
you'll find it there.
What I can do is to say that tomorrow, when I talk with him again, we will get the URL, and I will call our webmaster, and we will have LeGrand's site connected to Enterprise. There's a whole series down in the open hailing frequency section at the bottom of the first page of other sites that we even include Mike Malins, you know, the Mars surveyor camera person, who is not exactly one of my favorite people, and vice versa, I guess. But I'm trying to present a balanced perspective. So LeGrand's site, which I saw for the first time through Suzanne's computer this morning, is one heck of a site. Has a lot of excellent background data. It's the beginning of the conversation. We will link it to our site in the next 24 hours. And as new data presents itself and more pieces of this puzzle fall into place, I will have no compunction of coming on the air and talking about it.
And your site is www.enterprisemission, all one word, .com. And I want to thank you, caller, for calling. Hi, you're on the wee hours.
Hi, Richard. One of the things that the point that really brought all this home to me as being true was the night on Art Bell when you shocked everybody with the Old Navy. That really made me realize that this is not anything like it's entertainment or just fun and games. This is like. That just really brought it home. I don't know why, but could you give some background on that, how you got onto that and what the current situation with that is?
That's a really interesting part of the puzzle. You know, for many years, and I'm going to use some terms here that I'm not involved in, but I'm going to put them on the record so that we can have a common point of reference. For many years, the UFO community, which this is not. This is not UFOs. This is ruin. This is archaeology. This is ancient historical legacy. This is stuff. It's not things that go bump in the night and flit around and flash in the sunlight. But the UFO community, which is the only group in our society that we look to or have looked to kind of arbitrate and discuss these kinds of things, those people have had an awfully difficult time. Because not only is the data incredibly controversial and constantly argued over, but various people tend to show up and take away the data, like take negatives and take photographs and kind of threaten people and intimidate people. And they've now made a movie about this group of people. They call them the Men in Black. Well, interestingly enough, on the night in Pasadena when we did our presentation, there was a genuine man in black in the audience, one of the 600. And he was dressed in black from head to toe. They called him an Alec Baldwin lookalike. And he apparently interacted with almost every one of those 600 people. We have more cross-references to this individual with his Nokia cell phone and his polished black shoes, Gucci, of course, and his button-down shirt and his black tie and his black suit and impeccably groomed, but exuding a foreboding, almost alien air where people actually were nervous and apprehensive at dealing with this individual. We've always thought that whoever was manipulating this field was by axiom the government. They were them, the feds, the people who know everything and don't want us to know. Beginning sometime before the night I was on Bell talking about Navy, it has been a growing appreciation in our research, in my own mind, and among the colleagues that I interact with on this, that a much more interesting set of players at manipulating data, at filtering data, at censoring data, at leaking data, at withholding data, and in general playing head games with our hearts and minds, was not the government, but a substructure within society that I will call, for lack of a better term, the mystery schools or secret societies, which it turned out have extraordinary historical heritage. There are some agencies, like the Freemasons, that literally go back thousands of years, not just to the Middle Ages, which is the common wisdom, but they can trace their origins all the way back to Egypt and maybe beyond. There are others that are kind of amalgams that came out of the Renaissance, that came out of the reaction to a church rule and an opening of enlightenment and freedom and a reconnection with more ancient sources of knowledge. Then there are some that are the child prodigies of the 20th century and the prodigies of individuals who, within our historical lifetimes, have played major, if totally unseen, roles. And one of the stunning surprises that we were able to lay on the table on Thursday night, the 11th of September, just down the street from JPL, where these missions to Mars and the rest of the solar system are conceived, managed, funded, executed, data delivered, you know, presented to the public, filtered, the JPL itself had its origins in the clandestine and apparently almost totally unknown cooperation between one of the seminal occult magicians of the 20th century, a gentleman named Aleister Crowley, and another gentleman, an engineer, a brilliant genius named Jack Parsons. And that JPL, in fact, doesn't stand just for the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. In fact, the insiders in NASA have known for decades that it's really Jack Parsons' lab. Well, what is not known is that Aleister Crowley handpicked Jack Parsons to be his heir apparent in a system of magic and occult science, ceremony, ritual, whatever you want to call it, called OTO, which is a Latin term, Oredo Temper. I can't even remember what the Latin stands for. It stands for the Order of the Eastern Dawn. The point is that the very agency which is now the filter of data from the solar system is right in the center of the highway of the occult secret society tradition, which the old Navy conversation that you remarked about seems to be another wing of, in terms of playing with our minds about critical information that goes to the heart and soul of who we are and what are we all doing in this place. And it was the night that I kind of put some clues together regarding a television commercial on NBC, the night that Bill Clinton somehow had something radically weird happen to his knee just before the Helsinki conference, and the night that the lights appeared over Phoenix, which was March 13th, 1997, this year. All of that came together, and I realized that one of the visible tips of this secret society iceberg might well be a group that masquerades under this chain of stores called Old Navy, whereas, in fact, it might be a very convenient front, a cover, for a few Old Navy stores that were doing more than just selling clothing. And the way we got onto this is that there was a commercial where something, I believe it was Scotch plaid shirts, were being sold at sale for $16 and something, when they were supposed to normally run for $19.5. And what I had people do after I went on Bell and kind of laid out the model that maybe Old Navy was a cover for a group that had preserved ancient secret knowledge for a long time from a former planetary catastrophe where a Navy, by definition, would most likely survive to pass the information on to the next generations. Because you can't do much to a ship in the middle of the ocean. Even a tsunami passing at 600 miles an hour would be unnoticed by a submarine or a ship on the high seas. So I had people the next day go to all the Old Navy stores they could get to. Thousands of people. And I had them go in carrying a tetrahedron, which is a four-cornered, four-sided pyramid, which when you put it in a sphere, the points touch at 19.5 degrees. And I simply had them ask, where's the meeting? Well, the reports that came back not only dumbfounded me, but dumbfounded Art Bell, because it turns out that some people had called the same 800 number and had somehow gotten into a secret phone system that gave them codes, gave them billings, gave them employee information that sounded much more like a paramilitary organization than a bunch of mild-mannered clothing store operators. And outside of some key stores, there were a recurring set of symbols. The same kind of symbols you can read if you go and get the books from Manly P. Hall up the street, or if you are privy to some of the arcane wisdom of some of these secret societies, or if you've been following hyperdimensional physics, which is what has come out of our investigation. The point is that simply by posing the question and getting a lot of involved people to put themselves on the line and go and ask the question, the most amazing things fell out from people who were not comparing notes. We didn't tell them what the symbols were. We simply correlated the same symbols from all over the country, the same set of anomalous circumstances, the same set of funny phone codes. And the bottom line is that I think that some Old Navy stores, like that little dry cleaners in The Man from U.N.C.L.E. Remember where you went in and you pushed the third hat rack on the left and then you went down to, U.N.C.L.E. headquarters underneath Manhattan? It's beginning to look as if there is some secret society masquerading under the Old Navy banner that isn't quite into clothing.
Thanks for the call.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, good night. I can see how compelling these mystery schools could be, because just listening to the last presentation from the Pasadena event, and it was Nick Skouras who did the history of JPL, I got totally drawn in. I thought, oh, this is fascinating. So
nobody knows it. It's totally unknown history, but it's absolutely factually easily checkable, easily documented, and we haven't even gotten to the Army Operation Paperclip part.
Well, let's not, tar everybody with the same brush, if that's the right metaphor, because, the mystery sacred traditions, these sacred societies also carried the sacred knowledge.
Yes.
And, there's a lot to really be grateful for that, we've had at many times of great repression in the outer world, that the really important, mystery religious sacred secrets have been held protected.
Oh, I'm glad you made that point, because that's my belief as well, and I'm glad you made that point.
But there seem to be branches of this
But guys, the
category.
Corollary is a modality which is appropriate for one time, which has a function, which has a purpose, to protect important information against destruction, and the modality for protecting it is secrecy, can be out of date and out of tune and out of step in another time.
But that's not the subject matter. That's another subject. The subject matter of this is there are branches of that, and perhaps some of the branches were really quite underhandedly not so good. Now, in terms of the times changing, in fact, if you go into something like DK and the Alice Bailey material, DK said so many years ago that this time was going to be the time when it was time to reveal the secrets, and that it, in fact, he predicted, that it would not be appropriate to remain secretive forever. So, this very positive track in which, yes, that would correspond to just what you're saying.
Hmm.
Let's take a moment for people who just tuned in. You're listening to the Wee Hours here on 90.7 FM, KPFK. Listener-sponsored Pacifica Radio for all of Southern California. I'm Madeline Chua, my special guests, Richard Hoagland and Suzanne Taylor. And we're taking calls, but if you don't get in, and if you want to know more about what we're talking about, Richard's going to be in Orange County Wednesday, October 22nd, 7 p.m., a phone number, 714-520-4836. This presentation was given not exactly the same, because there's always more information in Pasadena, taped by She Who Remembers, and there's information at our switchboard as to how you can get a hold of those tapes. Should we take another call?
Yes.
Hi, you're on the Wee Hours.
Yeah, hi. I first would like to say that I was introduced to Monuments on the Moon. I believe that's the title of
the Monuments of Mars.
No, the first tape on the moon structures.
No. That was number three. That was the presentation I did at Ohio State.
That was
the
first one I was introduced to.
Ah,
the first tape that I saw.
Okay.
I was totally blown away, and what attracted me to that, and then I went on further and said, I've seen the other tapes, is the logic of the mathematics, which I won't even pretend to understand most of it, and the at least seeming to me factual bits of information I can grasp onto. What happens to me, though, when you start to go on about crop circles and Men in Black. Not that I don't, I'm not saying I don't believe in it. I don't want to bring a negative twist into this. But sometimes I feel like I get lost, and I wonder how you decide which information that you choose to bring in to talk about the Face on Mars, to show us that it's true, I guess. How do you decide which information you bring into your own, to add to your own information? I don't know if I'm making myself clear.
Kind of. I'm intrigued that you're disturbed by some of this.
That's why, you know, I just sound negative.
What is it that disturbs you?
Well, I think, like crop circles, for example, or the Men in Black.
No, all right, let's start with crop circles. Okay. Why do they disturb you?
Well, it disturbs me. You see all the time people talking about some crop circles were made by hand, and I don't, and it's hard for me. I don't know why I can think well, yeah, there could be life on Mars, and not think that, well, there could also be a connection to these crop circles. But
you know, may I suggest to you that I'm a crop circle person, and I'm the one that's been talking about them here, but may I suggest to you that just as you looked at Richard's information and were blown away, look at the information on the crop circles. That's all it takes. If you haven't looked at the information, it must sound bizarre, just like all of these anomalous things do. But just take a look at that information.
I have, and that's in, you know, they talk about these people that are supposedly, I know that obviously you can't make all the, you know, the logic says, well, you can't, all the crop circles that are made cannot be made by hand.
Well, no, to me this is really interesting because I think I understand the source of your disquietude, and I would like to, with your permission, pursue that for a minute. Mm-hmm. When I got into this, you know, I came from the straight world. I came from, you know, science advisor to Cronkite, consultant to NASA, Hayden Planetarium. You know, I picked up things like the Angstrom Medal. I was not prepared for the bewildering complexity of the politics around this or some of the issues that it brings up about who are we really and what are we all doing here. And I certainly wasn't prepared for connections between ancient and safely dead ruins, safely several million miles away, and the possibility that somebody right now in our own metaphorical backyard is doing something identical geometrically and mathematically and trying to tell us to wake up, pay attention. It's not dead. They're here. And I think that's part of your discomfort, because it's one thing to deal with ruins that are gone. It's another to deal with a presence that is somehow gently tapping you on the metaphorical shoulder and saying, take a look.
Right.
It's not gone. It's right with you now. Now, because I know the content of the message on Mars, because we figured out the math and we know what it means, and in Monuments, in one of the several editions, I put our own take on the early crop circles, not the latest ones, which have gone into incredible phantasmagorical artistic renderings that have multiple levels of impact and emotional meaning and content. We cross-correlated the geometry from the Mars material, the monuments, and these rather interesting early circles in the 91 time frame, and we found, lo and behold, the numbers were the same. The geometry was the same. The message was the same. Look to the physics. Now, in the crop circles, the message was multi-layered because part of this physics applies directly to biology. It applies to how living organisms will either thrive and flourish on planet Earth or not. And the message, apparently, at least from my decoding, is unless you get your act together and figure this physics out, you and all the other biology on your planet are in deep doo-doo. And I could expand on that, but we don't have the time. All right?
I wouldn't want to hear you expand on that, Richard.
On deep doo-doo?
No, I don't want to hear any more about that.
So, you know, for me, it's not disquieting, it's affirming. Because it means that, you know, there have been times when I've said about the Martian material, the monuments, the geometry, for those who cared enough to leave the very best. I mean, this message is exquisitely crucial to pulling ourselves up by our bootstraps and taking control of our destiny. And I could spend several programs discussing the physics. Anti-gravity is only one minor element to this, or free energy. But the disquietude changed for me when I realized that whoever was telling us this same stuff in the crops had, in essence, a non-manipulative, non-political agenda in that there it is. If we figure it out, fantastic. And if we don't, it's our responsibility.
You know, caller, don't take your crop circle information from the media. I can't believe that you would doubt them if you'd actually looked at some of the first-hand information. Because the media never does responsible stories on it. That is another astonishment.
Were you doubting them, or were you doubting the intent if they were real?
Well, it was more the fact that you tell someone this information. And when I saw your tapes, I believe I was preaching to all of my friends. You know, the truth is out there.
Mm-hmm.
And
Chris Carter thinks that.
Yes, exactly. and then when you like I said, I try to get my friends to listen. You have to listen to this information. This guy knows what he's talking about. And then you say, and I, please don't, again, I don't want to sound negative or disbelieving, but to say something like, well, they actually said there was a gentleman that, like a man in black, at their show in Pasadena, at their presentation in Pasadena. And then they go, oh, okay, well, wait, I'll believe it to there. Now, isn't that movies? That's all, you know, comic book.
It is more interpretive. I agree.
And so it's hard, you know, when you talk about moving into the, expanding into the public, becoming more accepting of it, that's why, you know, I wonder, oh, I want to leave that part out. I want to say, look, this is this part, but either you don't want to say, but the men in black were there, because you seem to lose people at that point, or at least...
Well, I mean, all right, in terms of relating this, that's a political judgment call. The fact that there were dozens and dozens of witnesses to this guy and his perambulations, I mean, he kept running out to the balcony calling someone on his Nokia phone, and two of the people that I've worked with for years finally caught him at the last part of the presentation calling somebody, a superior, and saying, sir, we've got a real situation here. Now, unless he was grandstanding and wanted to be caught and was just basically having fun, the fact is he was a man and he was dressed in black and he was reporting to somebody all throughout the evening, and he was personally debriefing members of the audience, people who were coming off the speakers panel, people who he didn't know were connected to Enterprise and would report back to us. We even got a photograph of him, and he then threatened the person who took the picture, who happens to be one of our seminal artists, Kinthea. She did the cover for the first edition of Monuments. Now, who he worked for and how serious we should take it, I mean, I'd take it tongue-in-cheek. I think that this was an individual attempting to, how should I say, intimidate. And, of course, we're light years past intimidation. And to me, it was an affirmation that somebody gives a damn. Somebody thinks this is important. And his questions of various people, including one of our speakers, was, in a very serious tone, how far do you plan taking this? And this individual, whose name I will not mention because I want to protect his anonymity, didn't quite understand the question. He said, do you mean how long are we going to go tonight? And the guy said, no. How far are you going to take this? Meaning, how much information were we going to present to those 600 people in terms of what we think we know? Now, this is a very interesting set of questions. I hope to God somebody's watching, because, frankly, we have figured some things out that someone in a position of authority or power or influence or whatever probably should pay attention to. So I felt incredibly affirmed and not in the slightest intimidated. It takes a lot to intimidate me these days.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for calling. I think it's important for people to respect their limits of credulity, but also to maintain an open stance. So that, you know, for instance, when he talked about the men in black, I think he was looking at it slightly differently than you were. And your explanation of it and how you interpret it, I think, was enlightening to him. But I think each of us has this place where we say, well, I can buy that, but not that. And the thing
well,
is, you just respect.
Well, don't think in terms of Tommy Lee Jones. I mean, come on.
Oh, I like to think in terms of him. Now, wait a minute.
Okay. Hi, you're on the wee hours.
Hi. Did you ever hear of a Stephen Schwartz?
Yes. Is this the archaeologist?
He did, was doing a...
Mobius.
Yeah, Mobius Foundation.
I don't know what happened to it because
he was actually
was
doing psychic archaeology. Wasn't he doing something on Alexandria?
He bought a van. He's traveling in the van, and writing another book. In case you want to know what happened to him.
Yeah, the Navy was funding a project on psychic archaeology.
Yeah, he's not doing that right now.
I know, but I was given some papers to be part of it, and I just figured if it's part of the government, there's no good that could come out of it. And very few people have heard of it, and it's very hard to find him. And most of the people I know that were given papers for it had been tested at UCLA, and most of them are gone. I mean,
When you say tested, you mean for psychic aptitude?
Yes.
Okay. Well, this was another form of remote viewing, in one sense, which has gotten, you know, rave reviews and a lot of press and hype. And I have very grave reservations about remote viewing. Be that as it may, Schwartz and a few people. There was a, wasn't there a Dr. Goodwin or from Arizona who was involved in an archaeology project where they used psychics to try to find.
I don't know.
But
Stephen Schwartz did some very respectable work like that.
Yeah.
With psychics as crew and looking for, you know, buried treasures and what have you. But you know, really investigating whether psychics indeed could reveal things. And there was just very good science done with that.
Thanks for the call. Hi, you're on the wee hours.
Hi. I had, first I got to say, you talking about losing people and their lows of credulity, you lost me with the Old Navy stuff. That just seems too far-fetched. They'd be broadcasting on the television and it'd be so readily accessible. But that's just a minor point.
No. Let me stop. You know, I don't want to let this go, all right? We live in an extremely complicated culture. We live in a culture where we are not one homogenous community. We are a set of sub-communities that have loose affiliations. And a lot of times when we talk to each other, we talk past each other. We don't communicate. Now, it's a standard axiom of operations, of shall we say, emergency preparedness, that if you want to reach everybody in a targeted community, the way to do it is to broadcast over open channels. And to do it in a way that if you don't want the information to be generally perceived or reacted to by everybody, you speak in a code. And the code is a preset code so that only the targeted population will recognize the code and then act upon the information, and everybody else will just let it go by as noise. If you view that story that I was telling you in that context, that somebody that night was being activated or being alerted or being signaled to pay attention to something, and the rest of us were not meant to intercept or decode or even understand that there was a signal, let alone that there was some event connected with the signal, then perhaps it would be easier for you to understand that this is going on a lot on all different levels. And 90% of the time, you're not aware that the information you see on television is, in fact, not really meant for you. It's meant for another targeted sub-part of the population.
Well, I could buy that, but I still have trouble buying that an organization that was so organized and so complex that they sent out information this way would, on the other hand, be so sloppily monitored that your people could, with very little effort, gain at least some preliminary access to this the information that you were talking about, the strange codes and the phone numbers and all that stuff.
Well, we'll just have to see where it leads.
Well, anyway, that wasn't my major point. My major point was, if you're talking about levels of worldwide organization, you know, that are so huge that want this information suppressed, wouldn't it take another organization counteracting them to protect people like you who are trying to get the information out? I mean, have you ever thought that the reason that you haven't been harmed or, you know, disappeared is because there's somebody protecting you?
You know, I haven't really thought about that a lot. I was having lunch today with a friend, and I was trying to describe that what we're dealing with in terms of information and its importance is not at the normal level of human conflict or conceit. The rules are very different. And if you start getting into the mystery schools, you find that a lot of times the information is only secret until you ask the question. And by asking the question, you automatically become privy to the information. It's like the axiom, when the student is ready, the teacher will show up. I had one of our researchers, you know, go to the National Archives the other day, and there was a particular person sitting at a particular desk, and the first thing that she asked my researcher was, "What are you seeking?" Not, "What are you looking for?" or, you know, "How can I help you?" but, "What are you seeking?" And her desk is 333, and her phone code is 333. Now, that may be totally coincidental, or it may be meaningful. This is an area which is very gray, which historically, for hundreds, if not thousands of years, has been marked by ambiguity precisely to keep those who should not know from even beginning to ask the right question. But as soon as you ask the right question, you're in.
Well, I could buy that, I guess.
Well, it's historical. You don't have to buy it. It's in any book on, you know, mystery schools that you want to pick out of the library. It's kind of, you know, Mystery Schools 101. Things get more interesting from there.
Thanks for your call. Hi, you're on the wee hours.
Hello.
Hi.
Hi. I want to thank you, Mr. Hoagland, for your work over the years. This is very interesting material. I'd like to take this back to the Cassini mission,
mm-hmm.
because I heard the broadcast on Roy's show also, and you have said that all of these space efforts seem to have certain hidden agendas, and I'd like to know, in regard to the Cassini mission, what patterns you see as far as what their hidden agenda for this mission might be.
That's a really interesting question. You know, I hate to admit it, but I've been so involved with Mars that I actually haven't had a lot of time to focus on Cassini. I do know that it's taking, you know, the long way home.
Yeah.
They launch it, and this has to do with engineering limitations of using rockets. It's a very heavy spacecraft. It carries a lot of instrumentation. But it has to go looping around through the inner solar system to pick up enough energy on these Earth swingbys to be, you know, billiard-balled out to Saturn over 7 or 8 years. I haven't looked at the launch times or day. I haven't looked at the arrival times with the computer to see if it matches some of this extraordinary Egyptian pattern that we found now in many of the other missions. But I almost don't have to, because I'm sure it does. The point is that all of this frontier find out new knowledge appears to be bounded by an incredibly ancient ritual that goes back to some of these mystery schools operating in a place that we would never imagine it should be operating, which is, you know, sterile, secular engineering NASA. That's the first astonishing surprise. The next surprise to me, and this is why I'm going to come back to the politics, is the kind of the brouhaha over the plutonium on Cassini. True, this is probably the most plutonium we've ever launched. But in fact, NASA and the DOD have been launching missions fueled by plutonium for electricity for 30 years.
Mm.
And, you know, the Apollo missions were, for me, the pointed example, because on Apollo 13, when the spacecraft, the lunar module, looped around the moon and brought them home in the lifeboat mode, when they abandoned her, Aquarius, just above the atmosphere, the plutonium carried in that package for the instruments designed to be set down on the moon wound up in the bottom of one of the deepest trenches of the Pacific Ocean somewhere off New Zealand. And when I was with Cronkite and CBS at that time, we were concerned that there would be radioactive release because it was barreling in at 25,000 miles per hour, and the casing and the cladding and the shielding around it would melt, and we were worried that there would be a release. Now, we were told that sniffer aircraft went out with Geiger counters sampling the reentry path to see whether any plutonium was released, and we were told it was negative. Of course, those were the days when we believed that NASA told us what was going on. I mean, maybe it did release radioactivity and they never told us.
I believe that Warren James on Hour 25 was talking about just that, when he was saying that it was fished out and it was reused.
No, that was a
that
was a transit satellite off Cape Canaveral. They had a rocket, a Navy satellite, lifted off and blew up, and the plutonium canisters were literally retrieved off Cape Canaveral. And they were refurbished and reused.
Is it a similar type of situation?
Well, they were smaller.
Yeah, okay.
You know, I mean, there was more plutonium for the ALSEPs on Apollo than for the transit satellites for the Navy. The point is that I've been looking at this sudden fuss over the plutonium on Cassini, and I've been asking what I hope is a deeper, more profound question, which is, why has NASA been targeted suddenly for an organized outside campaign questioning its veracity, its honesty, its forthcomingness, et cetera, but not on the issue of data or artifacts or civilizations, but on something that most people can get their heads around that is very up close and personal, namely, am I going to die of cancer after inhaling plutonium? And my question goes to, is this part of a concerted attack on the system at a level that a lot of people can understand over an issue that will involve a lot of people, whereas, in fact, the real war is a deeper, more profound, we have an agency which has been hiding most of the good stuff it's found and only letting us in on dribs and drabs that someone thinks we can handle.
Okay, well, I'd like to stay with my question regarding Saturn. Is there any, do you see any special significance or special interest that they might have wanting to do a Saturn mission?
Let me get back to that. In 1980 and 81, the Voyager missions that were launched in 77 and went to Jupiter and then went to Saturn and went on to Uranus and Neptune, these two missions went by Saturn a few months apart. And at Saturn, they discovered, in fact, the one of the experiments that was organized or prosecuted or managed by a friend of mine, Dr. Jim Warwick, who was then at the University of Colorado, a brilliant radio astronomer who had done most of his work on lightning and lightning discharges and radio waves emitted from lightning discharges on Earth. He became the principal investigator, the chief scientist in charge of an experiment flown on Voyager 1 and 2, to, among other places, Saturn, that was listening for radio waves coming from this giant planet. And in both encounters, the first Voyager and then 9 months later the second one, his planetary radio astronomy experiment, the PRA, picked up bizarre and wondrous and mysterious and incredibly important radio emissions from Saturn. And there's a very long and complex detective story, which I wrote as a cover piece for, among other things, Science Digest in, I can't remember the year. It was in the early 80s, or 81, 82, somewhere around there. And then I also did a piece for Analog describing this whole mystery story. And the bottom line was, what was causing the radio emissions? It turns out that the source was in the middle of the rings of Saturn. It was carving out a 100-meter-wide clear path in a section of the rings that's opaque for 3,000 miles, and one of the possibilities was it was an artificial station left by extraterrestrials.
And on that note, thank you so much for the call, and thank you so much, Richard and Suzanne. One more time, I'd like to mention that Richard will be in Costa Mesa Wednesday, October 22nd. Make sure you call, because I have a feeling there's going to be a big crowd. You want to get your reservations in. 714-520-4836, that information at the KPFK switchboard, as well as the information about how to get the tapes from the Pasadena presentation on the 11th of September, as well as Richard has promised a video out hopefully before Christmas. He has a website, easy to remember, enterprisemission.com, enterprisemission, all one word. Any last thoughts in about 20 seconds, Richard or Suzanne?
Well, I usually end an Art Bell show with stay tuned, because this is an ongoing work in progress, and the best stuff, the neatest stuff, is yet to come. And I want to say one special word of thanks to my host, Suzanne. She has been an incredibly gracious hostess in my sojourn here in Los Angeles, and without her importunings, we wouldn't have done this show tonight.
My final word is to see who else I host in this cross-connecting of the great minds that I like to offer a playing field for. Look at my website, mightycompanions.com.
mightycompanions.com. Well, I want to thank once again Richard and Suzanne and those of you who called and who didn't call but just listened. And we're going out with